average kinetic energy of the whole Dawn molecule, not just the outer shell. The whole Dawn molecule is shaking in position. You could call it a mechanical shake if you like. And the mechanical shake is very tightly coupled from one copper molecule to the next. If I manage to make one of them shake more violently, by springing action of his nearby neighbor, he will make that nearby neighbor also vibrate. Thermal energy couples through copper very efficiently. So,
auto-connecting.
Node number 9126.
Well, when I take the if I take the cold copper molecules and the hot copper strip, which are side by side, and I bring them together, it doesn't matter that they were two separate items and they're now touching each other, or if I heated up the left-hand side of one of the strips, the heat will spread to the right-hand side very rapidly because of this action. Thermal energy, average kinetic energy, is shaking in place. Yes, because they're shaking, because the whole Dawn molecule of copper, the whole Dawn atom of copper, is shaking in place. The outer valence electrons are shaking with it, and that's the mechanism by which my radio receiver will measure more noise of a 50-ohm resistor that's hotter. Even though it's made out of solid materials, the outer electrons are moving with the whole Dawn molecule, and yes, they're hopping from molecule to molecule, and that action is more violent because of the physical shaking of the individual molecules. Thermal energy is average kinetic energy, translational kinetic energy of the whole Dawn molecule. Until I hit that copper molecule with a very specific wavelength, that's just the right number of ergs or joules per photon, then I can excite those molecules to a higher orbit. In general, that does not happen with a convection oven. I know you and I have got some strong disagreements on this one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Well, I'm not sure that we're... It sounds like we're getting closer here again, except, see, the only difference that I see right now in the way you're describing it and the way that I'm describing this is that when I say that there's vibrations between atoms and molecules, I'm calling it energy, and I'm saying that the interreaction between each molecule or each atom at that particular point, in other words, when it's kicking up, basically, or sharing valence energy cells in a balanced material like copper, where all the copper is the same, and that energy is moving back and forth. I'm saying that that's the electrons, but the energy is transferring because of the electron orbits around each other and how they're interfering. Now, where I disagree with you is at the point that the nuclei, where the protons and neutrons are in there, are they moving? I would agree that the energy level around them is moving because of what's going on in the valence shells between one atom to the next. So the energy is transferring because of that. But is the nuclei actually vibrating back and forth? I would say probably by definition, no. But I think everything else that you've been saying so far I agree with, and it's how that's moving. But it's just how is it, what is the motivation for the nuclei in the center to be vibrating? That one is a very, very hard sell for me, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, you're saying that the whole molecule as a unit is not allowed to vibrate in place, shake back and forth, as if it's on a bunch of springs. In other words, the relationship between the nucleus, the protons and neutrons, and the electrons that are in orbit around that nucleus, you're saying that I can't keep that relationship constant and translate back and forth by vibration the whole Dawn copper atom. I can find a number of websites that will say what I'm saying. I can't find websites that'll say what you're saying. So I'm having a problem accepting it. Vibration in space is the definition of higher temperature of a solid material. Translational speed of the atoms or molecules is the definition of higher kinetic energy and therefore higher temperature of a gaseous molecule, gaseous material. So you have to be moving the whole Dawn molecule as a whole without disturbing it. Translational. I can vibrate it in space as if it's held with a bunch of springs. The whole Dawn molecule acts like a non-deformable object, but it's held in place by a bunch of springs, and I can shake it back and forth, and how much I shake it, I call that temperature. That's what my thermometer measures, average kinetic energy of the whole darn molecule. So when I move the whole darn molecule by shaking it in place, does the nucleus move with it? Absolutely. The relationship between that nucleus and those electrons does not get disturbed, per se. That's what I'm saying. I think you're saying something different. Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, actually I am. And let me define it, because I think we're getting closer now into an agreement on something. And I guess what I'm talking about here is the photon itself. In other words, what is a photon? And it was the energy unit for each atom in copper, let's say. So what's actually happening there is that if you look at the energy unit associated with each copper atom, basically it has an energy level. And that energy level is being shared with all of the copper around it. So now that photon is in motion. So it's an energy level associated to a mass, and the energy is transferring in the photon. But is the whole nuclei moving? I would say not. I would say it's the electrons that are the motivator. The photon is basically the energy unit associated with that, either in this particular case, atoms of copper. And we're seeing the photon energy being transferred violently at higher temperatures. So that's what I'm saying is actually happening here. But is the nuclei itself vibrating back and forth? No, I believe it's the photon energy associated to each copper atom. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Of that copper bar at 25 degrees centigrade, sitting on my table in my experiment, it's in a 25 degree centigrade room. The whole room is 25 degrees centigrade. The copper bar is at 25 degrees centigrade. Are photons coming out of that copper bar? What is their wavelength or band of wavelength? What wavelength are the photons of the copper atoms of that bar in thermal equilibrium sitting on my table? What wavelength or what frequency or what rate? Tell me something about the photons that are coming out of that copper. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, up here again. Now this is outside my area of expertise, but I'll tell you from what my general understanding of it is that at a specific temperature or wavelength, there's a wavelength associated to the temperature of copper, and that wavelength will basically represent that it is copper at a temperature. And from what I understand, I believe it's in the lower infrared, but I'm not sure about that. I have to look that up on a table. But it does have a frequency associated to it, and with that specific temperature, from what I understand, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yes, it is at lower frequency of infrared. As a matter of fact, the detectors for the security systems are passive devices. So what they do is they have a lens, which is a piece of plastic with zillions of micro lenses on it. And what is happening is each one is sending to the photo element the beam on infrared from the surrounding environment. Now, each one of these elements has different temperature, even though the temperature of the surrounding is 25 degrees. Let me drop. Now, when the person moves in front of the motion detector or in the pool of the motion detectors, the infrared steady pool, which is the passive detector, is changing in some of these lenses. That's how the detector is able to, the photo element is able to detect the differentiation in the steady pool. So what you're saying is the piece of copper is lying on your table. That piece of copper does not, in any circumstances, have the temperature of 25 degrees. And turn to it.
Glenn, you said that there is a frequency coming out of the copper. Absolutely not. every single frequency is coming out of that copper. Literally DC to gamma rays. Every single possible frequency is coming off that copper. With the right kind of thermal imaging cameras, instrumentation, I could measure the amount of thermal energy coming off that copper at each individual frequency, each individual wavelength. It'll be an extremely broad curve, the so-called Rolle-Jeans curve, and the displacement. There'll be a certain peak, in other words, at a particular wavelength, depending on its temperature, that energy at all frequencies will have a very gentle, broad peak. And as I heat it up, that peak goes to a higher frequency, lower wavelength, and all frequencies emit more. In other words, here's the copper at 25 degrees C. I've got this very broad curve that's got a very broad peak to it, all frequencies coming out of it. I heat it to a higher temperature. Every single one of those wavelengths is more energy coming out. And the whole curve not only gets higher up, but shifts a little bit to the right, higher in frequency. That's what a hotter object does. Assuming it's a black body radiator. And until I get to the optical frequencies, copper does do that. Well, I get a little bit of a problem here now.
Dick, how do you explain after 20 days of darkness, where there was no light, someone moves in the room, and the mouse detector is able to discover the changes?
By the way, Dick, no disagreement with you there. KC2QIQ.
So when you say there is a frequency coming out, it's all frequencies coming out. And the peak of the curve shifts slightly. I go to a hotter substance. Every single frequency gets more emission, and the curve shifts a little bit over to the right. And we've all seen that curve in some of the good books. Now, I've worked with a guy for a whole lot of years now who worked for a motion detector company. And the motion detector company used both pyrolytic detectors as well as a 10 gigahertz microwave detector. And it combined the results of both so that anybody moving in the room, unless they were extremely slow walking, and he practiced the so-called slow walking technique, and your breathing will set the damn thing off. It takes a lot of skill to walk slow enough not to create an alarm with this motion detector. It uses both pyrolytic, and it's got a whole bunch of, like you said, little lenses, and if any change in the environment took place, thermal environment, it senses that change and sets off an alarm. Those are very crafty items. And so everything above absolute zero is emitting an amount of energy. The amount of energy is a function of T to the fourth power. And it's emitting energy at all possible frequencies. There's no real resonance to it by the classic means of resonance like a dipole. But that very broad curve moves up at all frequencies when I heat the object up, and the curve shifts a little over to the right. That's not a resonance phenomenon by my standards, Glenn. I still have a bunch of molecules shaking in place. They're all shaking in their own, they're all doing their own thing. They're not shaking synchronously. If they were shaking synchronously, there would be a very specific wavelength coming out. It's an extremely broadband phenomenon. Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
Back on the HT, Dick. Can you still copy me?
Copying quite well.
Yeah, no, I'm agreeing with exactly what you're saying here. Now, I've seen the term resonance used for it. Not that I'm really agreeing with that. I mean, I understand what you're saying. I mean, certainly, you have that broadband curve, and it does have a peak up, and it is very specific to the, you know, to the temperature and wavelength. So they're a direct relationship, and you can find those points on curves and really determine from the amount of light energy at that point what the material is and what temperature it's at. So here again, you know, I think we're in agreement here. Just the word resonance, I agree with you, is a poor explanation for that phenomena. But here again, there are also a lot of books that mention that when that frequency, that peak point, an electromagnetic wave, it comes in contact with that material at that point, it's absorbed very, very easily. And I can show you probably lots of documents that show that. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
we're getting closer and closer to an agreement. But now here's the acid test. I take an O2 molecule and I cryogenically cool it to 1 millikelvin, a thousandth of a degree above absolute zero. It was moving around the room at room temperature at 500 meters per second. And I put this little cage around it, and my cage moves with it. So it's always in the middle of my cage. And as I cool it, its velocity, its translational speed, slows down. And I've now got it down to 1 millikelvin, and it's still in my cage. My magic cage always stays around this O2 molecule, always keeps the O2 molecule in the center of the cage. As I cooled it from room temperature down to 1 millikelvin, and the cage always positions itself in such a way that the nucleus of a molecule is always at the geometric center of my cage. And now I compare the diameter of the O2 molecule at 1 millikelvin of temperature versus 25 degrees centigrade of temperature. Will I see a difference in the diameter of that caged molecule? Over to you, Glenn.
The orbital diameter should be the same, Dick, as I said, but the amount of energy transferred from one to the other will be slowing down. KC2, QIQ.
And the method by which energy gets transferred from one molecule to the other is because they're bumping into each other, and I'm using the word bump with question with quotation marks around it. They never really touch. They get super close, and the electron cloud on the outside of each one of them has such a strong negative charge that they electrostatically repel each other. It is a perfect lossless bounce. But the rate at which they're bouncing against each other, because of their translational speed, slows down when I cool it down. But the diameter of the molecule does not change. Now, in our previous conversations, you were telling me temperature was raising them to a higher diameter of the outer shell of molecules. If that was true, when they jump back down, they would be giving off a very specific, very sharp wavelength, not this extremely broad curve of thermal emission. I think you've changed a little bit on that particular argument, I believe. Over to you, Glenn.
I think it's probably the way I was describing it on the radio, but the thought is still the same. And what happens is, when you look at electron transfer, in other words, energy is moving from, whether it be thermal or whatever, moving from one to the other. If one electron exchanges with another electron in the next atom next to it, there has to be a transfer of the electron, and the next one underneath it has to be bumped up before the share can take place. So that's what's changing. So there is a change in the orbits within the atom itself, but the overall diameter is exactly the same, if you follow what I'm saying. KC2 QIQ.
Well, I don't think I agree, but let me here's the test. I've got a 1 liter container, just out of curiosity, 1 liter container of O2 at room temperature, 25 degrees C. And those air molecules, those O2 molecules, I see are moving at 500 meters per second, bouncing against each other every 63 nanometers of mean free path. That means the rate at which a single molecule strikes another molecule is roughly 8 giga bounces per second. But we won't go there. But these air molecules are bouncing each other against each other at a very fast rate. Every bounce is perfect, and the bounces against the walls are perfect. It's all lossless because it's this electrostatic outer shell of repulsion is what the bounce really is. Are the O2 molecules in that 1 liter container at 25 degrees C, are any of the electrons from one O2 molecule flowing over to another O2 molecule? Is each O2 molecule holding on to his individual electrons, or is each individual O2 molecule, I'm not talking about the O2 atoms, you got a pair of O2 atoms combined together to get a pair of oxygen atoms combine into an O2 molecule. And yes, those two atoms are sharing sharing electrons. I'm going to give you that within the molecule. But is there any sharing of electrons from one O2 molecule to another O2 molecule in that container of my example? Over to you, Glenn, K2LAW.
The majority transfer between an orbit of lower level energy to higher level energy will share within the atom itself. Then, of course, if there's a bond, the bond will share the electron to the outside, to the bonded atom next to it. So there will be a transfer there. Now, the energy repulsion is due to the photon energy itself that's being transferred because of that reaction within that molecule to the next molecule. But it doesn't have to have an electron move or exchange between any two atoms other than the bonded atoms in order for the photon energy to transfer. But during that case, what's also happening is because of the repulsion, if it's a closed container, the pressure will increase proportional to that amount of energy. And also, you'll have the issue where if they're not stuck inside a closed container, they'll actually try to push apart and repel, just like you had mentioned. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay, between each oxygen atom of the pair called O2 molecule, electron sharing is taking place in that bond. I'm going to give you that. I am saying, Glenn, that the individual O2 molecules never come close enough to each other to share electrons. And if any electron jumped from one O2 molecule to an adjacent O2 molecule, that would be called plasma or ionization. You'd now have free electrons and slightly positive charged O2 molecules. That ionization in this example is not taking place. There is no plasma here per se. I'm not subjecting it to a high voltage which would make it into a plasma. I say that no sharing of electrons takes place between any O2 molecule and any other O2 molecule. They never get close enough to do that. And if an electron jumped that gap, you would be having a plasma phenomenon. There's no plasma here. I wonder if you agree with that. K2LIW.
There's no disagreement, because that is how it works. Unless, of course, there's impurities, and then it wouldn't be O2 anymore. See, like, when you start talking about complex molecules, like water itself, it's not completely pure. But when the discussion is a specific molecule, as I said, remember what I said, it's the photon energy that's really being transferred, not the electrons. The electrons stay within their bonds and their atoms that they're bonded to. So, the atoms within the molecule that they're bonded to. So, in that case, yes, that's right. It's only the energy that's transferring between them. It's not the electrons migrating from one to the other, unless, as you said, there is ionization. And then during ionization, in that particular case, you either have to have impurities or higher energy level. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
Okay. I'm now studying those individual O2 molecules in this 1 liter container. It used to be at 25 degrees C. With my convection oven, I heat up the whole container to 50 degrees C. The total number of molecules in the container did not change. The average spacing between the molecules could not change. But now PV equals NRT tells me there's more pressure inside the second 1 liter container because it's now at 50 degrees C where it used to be 25. At the molecular level, what is causing me to sense a higher pressure? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, in that particular case, if the molecules are pure, like you said, and they're at that higher temperature, now there's higher pressure, what's basically happening is there's repulsion between those atoms or molecules in that particular case. So they're repulsing due to the photon exchange that's taking place between the atoms. But so they're actually trying to push apart, but because they're contained, the energy can transfer, but they can go RSWKC2QIQ.
Because they're at a higher temperature, is their average velocity of translation of the whole O2 molecule, is the average velocity of translation higher at the higher temperature?
As the energy is increasing, the frequency is increasing. QSL?
That's not what I asked. The molecules at 25 degrees C had an average speed of 500 meters per second at 25 degrees C. At 50 degrees C, is their average speed of translation greater than 500 meters per second? Yes or no? Over to you, Glenn.
I guess what's happening here, see, this is an issue where now you're talking about velocity. Describe this velocity to me first before I give you the answer, because what I'm kind of saying here is that the energy is transferring at a rate. And what's happening is, as the temperature is increasing, the rate is increasing because there's a frequency associated to a transfer.
When you go to that website that was suggested on that meeting we were having 2 days ago, and you look at those gaseous molecules bouncing around in that illustration, and you're allowed to change the temperature, the pressure, the volume, and whatever, you just simply increase the temperature. You watch the little red dots representing each individual molecule or each individual atom on that illustration. You see them move faster. Temperature in many sources is described as average kinetic energy of translation. They don't usually put the word translation in there. Average kinetic energy of translation, not rotation, translation. So the average speed, we can't call it velocity because the velocity's got to be zero because they're staying inside the container. They're bouncing in all kinds of crazy directions, but it all adds up to zero. The average speed, we can talk about. The average speed is greater in a higher temperature material. Temperature is average speed. That's where the average kinetic energy of translation is coming from. They are moving faster at the higher temperature. I'm not sure you agree with that. Over to you, Glenn, KQRIW.
No, I do agree, Dick. What happened was my HT ran out of gas. I lost electron flow from the battery to the transceiver. So I had to come back upstairs again. But yes, on that point, I definitely agree. I mean, that's how it works. I mean, you have a situation where as the energy level is going up, yes, that velocity increases, and there's a frequency associated to that, and that determines the energy level. And, of course, as you're heating, that velocity is increasing. That's the transfer rate from molecule to molecule. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Okay, at an extremely high rate, these molecules are bumping against each other. At an extremely high rate, they're bumping against the wall. Momentum must be preserved when they bounce against the wall. If they're moving toward the wall at 500 meters per second of pure x direction, in this simple example, striking the wall at right angles, at a normal angle, after the bounce, it must be coming away from the wall at exactly 500 meters per second. Because the momentum got completely reversed in direction of that air molecule, the wall must sense a force. The force that by Newton's third law created that change in direction of momentum. That force against the wall, you and I call pressure. The higher temperature material in the fixed container, with no escape for the gases to take place, the higher temperature means the molecules are moving at faster than 500 meters per second. They have greater momentum when they strike that wall. Therefore, the force on the wall is increased. That is what your pressure gauge is sensing. The rate at which they're striking the wall, the velocity at which they're striking, the speed at which they're striking the wall, the momentum transfer that takes place, that is where the extra pressure is coming from at the molecular level. I know this is simplistic, but for some people it works. K2RIW.
Yeah, and you see, here again, I'm not sure I'm completely agreeing, because, in other words, the bounce word is what's gotten giving me some trouble. I guess what I'm saying here is that repulsion that's taking place, because you're still talking about balanced materials. In other words, there's no ionization taking place here. It's just temperature rise. So as that energy and that temperature is at a higher level, I can see the photon energy obviously displacing, just like we were talking before, between from molecule to molecule, and that energy is definitely moving back and forth. And it's definitely controlled with a polarization, but is it bouncing? I'm having a little bit of trouble with that one. I can see how the repulsion is pushing it apart and pressure is increasing, but is it actually bouncing internally within it? In other words, so if there's migration other than just the energy moving back. But the energy, I can see how that moves back and forth. But the actual, the whole molecule itself vibrating, I'm not... it's a problem with definitions here, right? Dick, I honestly have to tell you at this point in time, I'm really not sure. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question. Okay, I've got a question for you, but then I'm going to pass it over to Wesley in a minute. You admit that the higher temperature of a gas, they're not shaking in space, they're really translating. They're freely moving as a fluid. And at room temperature, they're moving 500 meters per second of average speed. At a higher temperature, it's moving faster than 500 meters per second. That's the real speed of an individual O2 molecule. You're having trouble with the word bounce. I know for a fact that if the walls of the container are at 50 degrees C, and the molecules of the gas are at 50 degrees C, they're in thermal equilibrium. The molecule is moving with a speed greater than 500 meters per second. Let me pick a number, 510. I'm now studying molecule number 4. He is moving toward the wall at 510 meters per second in a direction normal to the wall. You didn't like the word bounce. So this molecule is moving toward the wall, 510 meters per second, at an angle directly normal to the wall. Tell me what happens next.
Well, here again, this is just like English definitions, and I think what's happening here is, at least the way I'm envisioning this, is that there's energy. In other words, if I look at the photon, in other words, okay, because that's basically the energy on that, between those molecules that's moving back and forth. There's electrons that are transferring energy. There's a bond. It's polarized. The energy is moving back and forth. I mean, that I can definitely see. But is the actual molecule itself vibrating, or is that the energy that's vibrating between them? I still have to stick to the point that where everything that I've ever looked at in this is that it's the energy moving back and forth. Is the energy associated to the mass? Yes, it is. But is it actually moving the whole, nuclei, other than just in a fixed position? In other words, pushing outward because of repulsion, because it's still a balanced molecule. So I still think it's the energy that's really being transferred and moving and creating pressure. But are the nuclei along with the whole molecule, rocking back and forth? I don't really see that. I see the energy moving, but I don't see the mass vibrating other than the energy move, because it's the energy that's creating the change. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question. When you talk about rocking back and forth, you're starting to talk about a solid. I'm talking about a gas. There are lots of good references that will say that the air molecules have an average speed of translation of 500 meters per second. Sometimes you accept that, and your last explanation about vibration within the molecule and vibration in space and sharing electrons, you're jumping into something else. Is the individual air molecule at 25 degrees C moving with a translational speed of 500 meters per second? I can show you lots of references that say that. Are they wrong? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, as I said, there's at the molecular level, when you're talking about velocity of transfer, and we're talking about energy and energy tied to mass, but is the whole molecule, it's out of my range here, Dick. I know how the energy is moving, but here again, you know, the rocking back and forth is still a hard sell for me. As I said, it's just, you know, looking at things at the molecular level. I mean, repulsion, that is kind of like a steady state kind of thing. You know, it'll push apart and it will be displaced at a point, but the energy is still, you know, being transferred from molecule to molecule very violently, but it could be held in position. So I think that the velocity that they're talking about there is the photon relationship of energy to mass that you're seeing being exchanged. So because there's a certain duality between energy and mass, when they talk about the movement at that point in time, it's not clear to me that the whole nuclei is actually shaking, if you follow what I'm saying. KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, I'm slowly becoming convinced you have not seen that applet, that graphic, that moving graphic on that particular Wikipedia website on the subject of, what was it now, gas. If you saw it, it would help. You see real, not rocking, not vibrating, you see real speed of individual red dots that represent air molecules, O2, N2, H2, whatever. You see them translating across the page with a rectangular outer set of markings that represents the container. You see them bouncing against each other. You see them bouncing against the walls of the container. You see some of them moving fast, some of them moving slow, but they have an average speed. Every so often you get favorable bounces and one of them will start moving real fast. Every so often you get another kind of favorable bounce where one of them almost becomes stopped until something comes along and hits it, so to speak. And every one of these bounces between air molecules and each other, or between air molecules and the container, are thoroughly lossless bounces. No energy is dissipated on each one of those bounces. It's a beautiful graphic. It gets a lot of the point across. It may be overly simplistic. It's looking at everything as a kind of kinematics. It's not talking about individual photons and energy transfers. It looks at it in a purely kinematic manner, somewhat like a billiard table. But these are perfect billiard balls on a perfect table. And I think air molecules in a fixed container come very close to that. Go ahead, Wesley.
And I do have a comment to that one, Dick Spill.
I'm listening. It's a very interesting discussion. I didn't get the answer. It might be a little bit off the topic, but it might be very much in topic. After 10, 20 days of darkness, you stated, Dick, that that material emanates many different frequencies. Now, there is a steady pull of infrared. I wonder, what is that energy coming from?
Everything above absolute zero obviously has a temperature. Temperature is something you can measure with a thermometer, among other kinds of instrumentation. A thermocouple, there's all kinds of things that can measure temperature for you. Temperature is measuring average kinetic energy of the individual molecules of that substance. Everything is emitting amount of infrared energy, which is a function of two things. Its emissivity and its physical temperature. When you're using a thermal imaging camera and you look at a piece of foam, expanded polystyrene, you see something that looks quite dark. You look at a piece of copper with a thermal imaging camera and you think you're looking at a mirror.
Yep, well, you're telling me very smart things. very much educational, but you're not telling me what is that energy coming from. You say it has the energy. It does. What is it coming from?
The energy being emitted by a substance that's above absolute zero is coming about because of the physical motion of its individual molecules and the fact that on the outer layer of that molecule is a charged cloud of electrons. The outside of that molecule looks like a heavily negatively charged object. It happens to have a positive charge in the center, in the nucleus, but you don't see that on the outside. On the outside, you see a negative charge cloud of electrons. And the molecules themselves, whether it be a solid and they're shaking in place, or whether it be a gas and they're really translating, those clouds of electrons are moving in a random manner. Whenever you move charge, you're creating an electromagnetic wave. Everything that is above absolute zero is emitting all possible electromagnetic frequencies.
Long.
Say again?
For how long?
Forever.
Okay, so now we're talking about something that is the source of the energy by itself forever. Now, a little bit more words about it?
You're about to say if it's giving off energy, how come it doesn't run down? And that's because it's also absorbing energy. Everything has an A over E index, absorptivity to emissivity index. That determines what its steady state temperature in that environment will be.
Where is the magnet taking the energy from? What is the energy exchange to the magnet?
I don't know.
So, we're getting close to the very much controversial area.
In the case of warm objects in a room being viewed with a thermal imaging camera, there's a thermal equilibrium going on. The objects are emitting, the objects you're absorbing, there's thermal energy all over the place. Where does the energy come from in a permanent magnet or an electromagnet? Now, let's talk about a permanent magnet, a neodymium magnet. Where does that magnetic field energy come from? I don't know. I'd like to know. I don't. It's one of those things where you can see it with certain imaging devices. I own some magnetic imaging material, this green stuff that shows you the lines of force. You and I can sprinkle iron filings on top of a piece of paper over a magnet, and we, by way of the way the iron filings align themselves, we see where the lines of magnetic force are. But what's really causing them? I don't know. I'd like to know. I don't know.
The same token, you don't know what is this energy coming, coming from. What is it? You say, that's what you said is, well, all we have is transmitters. Now, these transmitters are transmitting constantly the energy, but they have the receiving devices as well. So they are duplex devices, transmitting and receiving. Now we have a Faraday cage, and exactly dark one, and also in very much a steady insulation for the temperature exchange. Now, for how long this energy is going to be emitted? You say forever. It's just that I have a lack of words, but I know that you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, an object at, say, room temperature is continuously emitting energy and absorbing energy from the room, and that's what your thermal imaging camera can see. In the case of a magnetic field from a steady magnet, it's nice to say that energy is being emitted. Well, I'm not so sure it is. When we talk about power coming out of a magnet, the magnet is capable of making a force. And if I allow that force to work through a distance, now I've got an energy transfer.
Does the magnet tape emit photons?
I don't know.
Everything has to emit photons based on the explanation that I've got from you.
I don't know what a magnetic field is. I don't know if a magnetic field is photons.
Well, but a magnet by itself as a body has to emit photons.
As a thermal emitting device, the thermal energy coming out of the magnet, yes, those are photons. But the magnetic field, I don't know what that is.
Glenn, how about you?
Well, in the case of a magnet, Wesley, as far as I know, they're just fixed magnetic lines of flux. So it's at a energy state by itself. Now, unless you bring by something else that's going to interfere with that field, no energy is transferring. So when there's, you know, when you're in the steady state, it's hard to talk about photons at that point in time as far as with respect to that electromagnetic field, because it's just a steady state field. So no work is being done. Everything's kind of just like static. So, you know, when you start transferring energy and then it starts doing work, heat and other things, then you can start building your quantum model and talk about photons and how that electromagnetic field is affecting a mass. And then we can talk about, you know, what its effect on it is. But when things are in steady state, the whole idea of talking about a photon doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because there's nothing really, no work is being done there. Do you follow what I'm saying, Wesley? KC2, QIQ.
You have one magnet on the top of the other. And, of course, it's constantly in motion. The air, whatever, the movement of the air, the gravity, constant in the motion. You have always interference. Where is that energy coming from, Glenn?
Okay, so now you're saying that there's an interference. In other words, two magnets are passing by each other. Am I understanding you correctly?
You have a plastic rod, you have a magnet on the bottom and a magnet on the top, let's say in the form of the rings. Then you have a constant movement of the earth and changes into the gravity. And you have air, you have the temperature, you have always interference. Where is this energy coming from? We're talking about potential, theoretical, steady state, which is not taking place.
Well, you have to keep in mind, Wesley, that everything in, you know, in our universe is at a specific energy state all by itself. And when things are in motion, the way our universe works, things start interfering with each other. And at that point, now you start getting a potential difference between the items that start interfering with each other, and depending on which type of energy it is. So as they do it, it's the dissimilar, or the differences, or the relative differences between those energy states that start doing some kind of work until eventually they reach equilibrium, unless something pushes them into something other than equilibrium again, and start another energy transfer. So you follow what I'm saying there?
Yes, I do. So we're talking about the good try, or the attempt to stabilize, which is never happening. So the work is always being done. Now, at first, we do not know what is that force coming from. We do not know what is that steady state, primarily and basic molecular mechanism. Unless, then, you know.
Well, I mean, the universe is made up of all different types of materials at all different kinds of temperatures. Some have chemical reactions, like, you know, suns and planets, and some are emitters, some are absorbing. It all started with the Big Bang. I kind of believe in God, so maybe that gives you a hint there on that one. I don't know. Dick, I'm going to pass this one over to you. K2IW, KC2, QIQ.
What Wesley is describing is a ring magnet on the bottom of a plastic rod, let's say with north up, and you got another ring magnet on the plastic rod with north down, and you drop the second magnet onto that plastic rod, and they come together because of gravity, and maybe there's going to be a separation of 1.5 inches between the two, and that 1.5 inches will stay there forever. That magnetic force of repulsion between those two magnets, to me, is a little bit like the compression of a spring. I could have a spring between those two objects, and the spring will keep them separated. I could have the magnetic field, the opposing magnetic field between the two objects, and it keeps the two objects separated. The compression of the spring or the compression of the magnetic field in both cases represents potential energy that I could tap later on. I could allow that spring to expand through a distance, and I get some work out of it. I could allow those two magnets to expand across the distance and the force that they're creating. I get some work out of it. So the magnetic field or the compression of the spring are both a kind of potential energy. In the case of a spring, I'm really deflecting a chunk of steel, and I've got a pretty good feel for what's going on. In the case of those opposing magnetic fields that are pushing against each other, I don't know what that is.
You don't have the molecular deformation in case of magnetic field.
Well, at least I understand the model now.
In the case of the spring, I am deflecting chunks of steel that are resisting the deflection. Hopefully I'm not pushing them beyond the point of permanent deformation. I'm within the normal spring constant, and I can restore the energy. I did a compression, and I can allow the spring to expand. I get the energy back later on. And to some degree of similarity, with my fingers, I can push those two magnets closer together. They're acting like a spring, although I think they have an inverse square law where the spring is more linear. But still, there's a force versus distance. There's stored potential energy there, which I can get back. But what is the magnet really doing to create that so-called magnetic field that creates that repulsion? I don't know. If you had to explain magnetism, how would you do it, Glenn?
Well, there's some pretty complex chemical structure. I mean, if you want to go down to the chemical structure of magnets and how they, you know, how they actually work, there's a lot of interesting stuff over there. But I mean, basically, they're just static, you know, electromagnetic fields with polarity. Now, if you put opposing fields, they will repel. And there's no mass between them. That's just an energy field. But you can have energy in a state that's steady, and that would be that particular case. Now, I guess, are you asking me, Wesley, to go down to the next molecular level of what's going on within a magnet?
No, I don't. What I said is, when you compare this to the spring, when the spring is compressed, the bonding between molecules is different. And with the time, the spring is losing its own strength. As if we're talking about magnetic fields, we might say that if we state that something is unchanging within the lifetime of the human being, for us, is perpetual motion. Something that never changes, but it works all the time. It is not perpetual motion by itself because it is working by itself, but at least that we cannot even see that anything at the level of molecules is...
Back on again. Thank you, KC2QIQ.
And to see you. Dick, are you there?
Yes, I am. So, are you seeing that moving diagram, and what do you believe those moving blue balls and red balls represent, Glenn?
I'm not really sure yet, Dick. As I said, I'm just I'm trying to read through this article, and right now it's, okay, directly from collisions between particle gas and molecules. So if you can give me a little bit of time to study this a little bit and try to figure out what exactly this is.
Is there the possibility that those blue objects represent nitrogen molecules, the red objects represent oxygen molecules, and in the real world they're moving at an average speed of 500 meters per second? Obviously in this animation they're moving slower than that, but could that represent their individual mean free paths, spacing between, motions, encounters, encounters with each other, encounters with the wall? Could that represent the real motion of the freely moving air molecules? Is that a possibility that you can understand by looking at that diagram, even before you read the words?
Well, from my understanding, without looking at this, if I were to look at that motion that I see right there, if I have a container that's sealed, and I have basically air molecules at a specific temperature, what I would have, this is what I would expect the energy moving, because, in other words, right now you have nitrogen and oxygen, right, between the blue and the red, and that would be the way I would see that the energy would be moving back and forth. But would the atom itself be moving, or the molecules be moving like that? I'm not sure, Dick.
If so many references say that air molecules move with an average speed in random directions at 500 meters per second, if you didn't see the individual air molecules translating like they are doing in that diagram, what did you feel they're really doing? What does the 500 meters per second of average speed mean?
Well, my understanding is that, like, when I look at a model of, oh my goodness, see, now I'm getting late and I'm not thinking here, and I'm going to probably wind up saying the wrong thing, but what I'm thinking here is that when I look at molecules and I'm looking at a model of energy that's on that, that's actually happening, the energy actually can move quite freely, but the motion that we're talking about, like of the photon energy, is associated, you know, to transfer. But here again, are the actual molecules themselves really moving? I'm not sure, Dick.
If I've got a container of compressed gas, and I open up the valve, and air is squirting out of that valve, are the molecules moving?
Absolutely. And then what I could do is I could take a pressure, I could take a volume, and an open aperture, and determine what that expansion rate is as it's moving out that hole. That I can do.
As those air molecules squirt out of that nozzle, and I squirted them into that chamber, could they bounce around against each other and bounce around against that wall the way they're showing in that diagram?
What I would expect is that, let's say in the filling experiment in the beginning, that basically you could fill up the chamber, and eventually the motion between the atoms would eventually move to some kind of a displacement, but the energy would be moving back and forth within the displacement because it's trapped now within a container.
Okay, for 2 weeks now, I'm hearing on the Marchionne voice strong reluctance to allow steady state temperature confined gas in a fixed container that the individual molecules of air are capable of translating and moving, like in this diagram. I'm wondering why that's such a difficult concept. I guess it's the way you've been exposed to the material.